OK, so I won't repeat that introduction. This talk is going to be about disappearing tracks and other things. OK, I should remind you, although I'm sure you all know, that this talk is going to be about things that I've done previously. But really, it's forward-looking towards what we're going to do in run two. And I'll try to get to that by the end. And the good, nice thing is that run two has started. We had a little bit of a false start with a small little accident. I could talk to you more about that later if you have some questions about that. But let's celebrate the fact that LHC has started. We had the first circulating beams on April 5th. This thing is faint. So I'll just use the hockey stick. Then if you haven't seen a plot like this, this is the accelerator plot that people clap, because that's the beams on target going one direction, and then after it goes to around 27 kilometers and hits the same target after it's gone around. So when you see the second dot appear, then the accelerated division pops the champagne, because they've managed to get protons all the way around 27 kilometers, which is an important achievement. And then a few days later, that was April 5th, and a few days later, they were able to get to 6.5 TeV beams. That's this plot here. This is LHC page one, which is publicly available, but it's over the web. But it used to be the thing that you could see that's on the monitors at CERN. So you can always look up and see what's going on in the accelerator complex. And this is the first time we've seen numbers as big as that. So that's pretty cool. This is the CMS people celebrating. Well, what do we celebrate at this point? Well, we celebrate the fact that our detector seems to work. And that's just what you see here. This is what is called a beam splash event, where some of those beams were taken and intentionally defocused and slammed into a limiting aperture, which happens to be a collimator that's upstream. That produces lots of secondaries, and then we see that. So why do we want to see that? Well, because we've been fiddling on this device for the last 2 years, and we need to make sure that we've hooked it back up correctly, and so far, so good. Oh, yeah, I didn't say anything about the, right. So I should say something about it, because especially since it's changed in the last few weeks. So they could pick up some time, but there's been about a two-week delay. So really, it was supposed to be physics in the middle of June, and now it'll be physics at the end of June, I think. So we've basically lost 2 weeks from the physics run due to this delay. Your question was what's the difference between 13 TeV collisions and when physics can emerge? Yeah, there's a whole bunch of things that they need to check out, and so they will be. It's possible some of that data could be usable for physics, but it probably won't be, because they'll be dumping the beams. They'll be doing things like trying out different intensities and patterns and different fill patterns, like you said. Yeah, so I'm not sure what the whole program is, but you know they'll be fooling around with the orbit, the intensity, the bunches, and it won't be reliably good conditions. So some of those operations may be dangerous enough in terms of producing an accident that we'll have our voltages down. And that, whenever that's the case, then the data would be probably useless. But there might be. It doesn't mean that there isn't some data in there that you could use for physics. But in practice, yeah. And so in practice, we won't use that data. It'll just be too confusing if we tried to. Okay, I'll say a quick thing about what the goal of this run is, in my view. This is the slide I guess I don't really have to say to you guys, because you certainly know why we're doing run two of the LHC. But from my two cents, it's that we have these two big programs. One, we try to find direct evidence of BSM states. And two, we're doing measuring the increasingly precise properties of the particle that we discovered in the last run. So fully, half of the collaboration or more is probably engaged in one of the two of these activities. There are other things, but they're a small fraction of the remainder of that activity. And for the second thing, we've basically...
What is the fraction of people who just do other model
It's really small. out of, you know, 3,000 people, it's probably 100 or something like that. A few hundred maybe, but you know, it's a very small percentage. Some standard model processes are essentially very tightly coupled to some of these other things, so some people, you know, are involved in both. And but people who are just doing purely standard model stuff that doesn't have any tie into BSM or Higgs is really, really rare. So if there's something you are very concerned that gets measured precisely, you should bang on that someone does it. I mean, somebody will do it, but it may just be one person, and it may come out 5 years from now. But okay, as far as this talk is concerned, the second item is we don't need to talk about that. We already know how to measure the couplings. It's basically, here's a plot of the latest values from the Higgs data that we recorded in run one, and all we're going to do is grossly oversimplifying things, but all we're going to do is shrink those error bars over the next 15 years or so. For searchers, though, it's more complicated on even the philosophical level because as many of you know, because we've been here to do workshops on this very topic, we're concerned, as you are, that we carry out the search program such that we don't, if we don't find anything, that's a meaningful null result. If we had just been real sloppy and left lots of loopholes, and then we shut the machine off, you know, you don't know what to make of that, and we would be very disappointed. So that means we have to look under rocks. And I picked this picture out because I thought it was a good picture of a guy looking under a rock. I have a friend who's a field biologist. I'm now almost certain that this is a picture of him. It's amazing. Totally random, but I'll get to ask him later. Anyway, so because we have to look under rocks, this is something that, as I said, we've covered here in previous workshops. You all know about it. It's been a lot of you have been working on. We first started the run going after the low-hanging fruit, and that we got rid of pretty quickly. So we were in this situation, okay, we're done. You know, you saw the headline, supersymmetry is dead, and then lots of people rightly said, not so fast, and they pointed out all of, you know, some of you and many others have pointed out all of these loopholes. For example, the first searches assumed that you'd have R parity conservation, so you'd have these large missing ET signatures, and of course, that's not necessarily the case, so we had to relax that constraint and develop new analyses to plug that hole. You could have the similar situation where you're not sensitive, where the spectra are compressed, and so you don't have enough energy, much less missing energy, to find. These are always going to be hard to find, but we've done a better job of trying to close it in. And personally, I don't think, you know, you could always keep pushing that further and further, and that's not particularly interesting unless you come up also with a clever idea how to dig that out. So just as a suggestion to model builders, so maybe pointing it out that we know about it and we're doing our best to fill that in. The triggers will be better in the next run, so we'll cover that even better. Another thing that people point out when you bring up our results is that, well, you know, my theory has a branching ratio into many, many things, and you only excluded things with 100% branching ratio. That's true too. The limits are not as strong if you on particular models because maybe they're branching ratios into things that we haven't seen. So we've tried to cover that, so that's not the case. We've even tried to present our results differently so that we cover that as well. But my one sentence summary is that I think most of these loopholes have been closed at this point. I mean, I'm looking at it today because I gave this talk in ICTP where we went over them, and there was not much other than the one notable exception that came out of it that I'll talk about a little bit later about what we might be missing. Okay, and then one more thing, which is on this menu, which has also been addressed in run one in many ways, is long-lived particles. But this I wanted to focus on more in this talk because this often requires specialized reconstruction or using the detector in a way that it maybe wasn't designed for. And those things are the harder. Those are the tricky experimental signatures that I wanted to give you the the details on. So in this turning over rocks, it's important that we turn them all over. But you know, there are biases that you have. We were going after the low-hanging fruit because we were trying to be pragmatic, but we probably have done that again a little bit in trying to turn over all the rocks, because there are some things, like I just said, with this compressed spectra, you know, that if you compress it enough, it becomes hard enough, and so we're just sort of ignoring that. If nature happens to pick a point on a very compressed spectra, that's like one of these little pebbles that we just didn't get around to turning over. That would be unfortunate, because I don't think we have a guaranteed way to search all of them. So maybe we can't do too much about that. But then there's also the case where there's something that we know we should do, but we're avoiding doing it because it's very difficult. So that's just a metaphor of the heavy rock that we just don't want to even try to push. And that is definitely a bias in our program, because it's one you can't really get around, because it some of these things, these tricky experimental searches, may take a long time to do. The average search takes about a year, okay? So if you do something significantly non-standard, if you try to use the detector in a way that it wasn't designed to do, don't forget CMS now and ATLAS, they're 20 years old in their design. But even in the code that's been written to exploit them, that's built up over 15, 10 years. And even though if you throw out some of the earlier stuff as being maybe not so useful anymore, that's just not true. Even, you know, you still have many years of many thousands of people who effort into this. You can't just say, okay, because, you know, I want to do something different, I'll rewrite it from scratch. Good luck. Well, you have to be very sure that that's a good idea. And the worst one is tracking. So that's what I wanted to highlight in this talk. And to make the situation worse, you come to a place like this, and you know a few hours, you get lots more things that you need to do. Okay.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So no, that's your job. You shouldn't apologize. But I thought my idea in this talk is to communicate to you what it means when you show up with the dump truck, okay? I don't know if there's any significance to that, nor do I know why Ite has this big, giant rocket. So you have to find a balance between, you know, the theoretical motivation and the experimental difficulty. And the best things, like this project that I'll tell you about later, they cover lots of, they're not so hard, and they cover lots of possible theories. That's the best thing. That's what you're always looking for. I'm going to go back a little bit to talk about, since I was thinking about tracks, the furthest back thing with LHC that I did with strange tracks came from this paper that I was brought to my attention by Patrick Mead at Aspen a couple years ago. Maybe some of you were there. And he told me over coffee about the CDF anomaly. And what did I think about that? I'd been on CDF for 10, 15 years or something, and I never heard of the CDF anomaly. I mean, I wasn't on it at the time. But so this was surprising to me. And so this is the CDF anomaly. You guys probably are aware of it. But they plotted just the tracks, charged tracks, as a function of PT, and it should follow this prediction from power law from QCD, and instead there was this sharp or significant many orders of magnitude deviation at the highest PT. And that was, you know, inexplicable, right?
The small word correction
is... Yeah, okay. Yeah, right. So people didn't know how to explain this, and it was brought to CDF's attention, and their response was, okay, we screwed up. We issue an erratum. If we tighten the track criteria, you know, the chi-square, the number of hits on the track, that this thing goes away. So that in principle, that's the end of the story. But Patrick wrote this paper which said, maybe that's not the case. Maybe the CDF just swept this under the rug. I looked at your papers from LHC, and you guys have many more tracking layers. You're making much stronger cuts from the beginning. So maybe you don't see that. And then he made a suggestions of some ways you could explain it. And to be honest, this paper isn't the best paper, but because it doesn't really make a very compelling case for the particular model that they suggest. But the idea that you could have something weird going on, I thought was worth checking out and not too hard to do. So I decided to look into it. Okay, and one particular case that was suggested was, well, what if there are fractionally charged particles? So when you have a fractionally charged particle, you necessarily measure the momentum wrong, because the curvature is proportional to the charge. So if the charge is really a third, you don't know that. So you're off by a factor of three in the momentum. So that would be the way that you could reconcile. So these points are in the wrong position on the plot, right? That's you measure them at the wrong momentum. So that's how you can get. It's a leakage, yeah. So that was Patrick's idea in the paper, and I thought that was a good one, that maybe that's what was happening. Okay. I looked in the literature. Nobody had done a direct collider search for fractional charges in a long time. People cited a result from CDF from run one or run two, which was a misreading of that paper, and the results that people cited from that just really didn't apply. And nobody had pushed the boundaries on it to see how far they could go in charges. So if they did anything, it was charged two-thirds. And really, you had to go back to Opal to find something. So we decided to do it. And this is, so we were, and we wrote this paper where we looked for an excess of tracks with an anomalously low ionization on six more hits. Basically, if it's a fractional charged particle, the energy deposition goes like a Q squared. So if it's a third charge, you're going to get 1/9 the energy. If it's a two-thirds, you'll get 4/9 the energy. So that should be statistically significant low ionization if you examine all of the hits on the track. And the thing I think that came out of this that was interesting is that we found that this question is, does a track have N hits with low ionization? If you ask that question, coincidentally related to our discussion this morning about the binomial distribution, this is a binomial question, and these data follow a binomial distribution to an astonishingly good degree. So this is not a fit. This is not a Monte Carlo calculation. This is an analytic prediction from the binomial formula. Right here, to generalize binomial so we could draw a line. From over several decades, the data for hits on track in CMS follow this distribution. So if there were a signal, that would show up out here. And this prediction is so incredibly precise because it's got so much data and the functional form is known analytically, that this would be, it was an extremely powerful way to just say whether there were any fractional charges in CMS. In fact, when we wrote this paper, we didn't see any events, as you can see there. But people had an issue with these kind of very low background predictions. They said, how can you know the backgrounds that well? It was because we really knew the backgrounds that well. And so this is the kind of situation you really want to be in, where a handful of events almost has to be a discovery. And of course, whenever you do such a thing, well, at least in my experience, you find something. If you do it right, you find something the first time around because you make a very accurate prediction as with all the knowledge that you have, and then it turns out to be wrong, and you learn something. So then it's not a waste of time. So what we saw when we first made this is the preliminary plot that I'm probably not supposed to show you, that there's a shoulder down here just right in the region where you would see a low DEDX signal. Now, this was in a control region where we knew it couldn't be signals. These things were, I can't remember now, I think that we knew there were Zs or something. So there was some standard model tag that we knew these events, the tracks in these events were not BSM. But nonetheless, it produced this shoulder, which would be exactly what we were looking for in a signal. And when we looked into this, we figured out that this assumption that we made about the binomial distribution, this holds for uncorrelated hits. If there's no correlation between when you get a low ionization from one layer to the next as you're propagating through the tracker, then it will follow this distribution, and indeed it does. And a signal, obviously, there would be a correlation because the particle has the same charge each time it goes through. But we found out that by looking at it, that there is there was a correlated way to get low ionization in tracks at CMS. And that's because tracks go through pieces of silicon like this, and pieces of silicon have edges. And if a track goes through the edge, some charge shares into the next layer and you get that, but some charge shares to the guard ring on the outside and you don't get that. So if you go near the edge, you actually lose some charge and you might think it's a low ionization. And you would think with so many sensors that most of the time that wouldn't be correlated. You'd hit the edge of one, but you wouldn't hit the edge of the other. Well, we found that in CMS, there happens to be just a few trajectories where you hit the edge of every single one as you go through. So that produced this edge. And then of course, once you know it, you just make fiducial cuts. It's easy to get rid of. And so that's one thing we learned, and I thought that was useful. We know how the silicon detector works as far as low charges. We also learned that the charge equal to 1/3 was basically the limit for CMS. It was too hard to push it beyond that. This is because of what I said before. The efficiency goes like the Q squared, and so you know at 1/3 you're at 1/10 the efficiency, and that's just too. Everything's designed. That's beyond the design parameters of almost all the detectors. So you can't. Did you say something?
So did that search really kill the
ethanol? Oh yeah, that killed the anything that that model was not a very good one. I mean, you guys are theorists, so you should. Think about that, but it killed it certainly killed the model that was proposed to explain it, as far as I know. But I think that model had other issues anyway. But you know, if somebody comes up with another one, you would have to take that data into consideration. It's pretty powerful for 1/3. We set some limit. Let's talk about it later. I don't remember. We didn't make a specific effort to try to compare it. We cast limits in a way that you might be able to reinterpret things, and let's talk about it afterwards. There's some cute things that came out of that, actually. We ended up setting limits on quirks, which was a kind of interesting, cool side thing that Nate Craig came up with. Let's talk about it later. Okay, because I want to get to our project, and I don't want to. So that you know, you never know how and why things work. But one thing is for sure is I knew that we couldn't go beyond 1/3, one charge below charge 1/3. So I was primed for this suggestion that came out at ICTP last summer. Itay and Eder and me and Andy Haas, we came up with this idea for looking for millicharge particles with a new experiment at the LHC. It's a modified beam dump experiment where you're looking off axis. I was talking to many of you all this morning about it, so I know you know all about it, so I don't need to go into it too much. But I guess the point is that I knew if you wanted to go after this, you can't use CMS. You have to do something different, and that was useful information. Okay. So now one aside. Slide just so I can show a little bit about this since I'm here and this is a PI project. For those of you who are interested, we found the site for this millicharge particle detector. It's the old control room at CMS. That's it right there. It's pretty much empty. In terms of where it sits relative to CMS, this is a two-scale model. That's the construction shaft and this is the elevator shaft. That's CMS right there, and this is the room that we're talking about over there. So it's about 15 degrees above CMS, and about 20 meters away is what we were guessing, but looks like a little bit more than that in that picture. So what are we doing? Well, we're trying to find a name for this project, so anybody has any ideas? We're going to go to this room this summer and make measurements to evaluate the feasibility. We're writing a simulation. This is a JOINT simulation that we have now. If you haven't seen that before, either of you guys, I don't think you have, right? This block here is the wall, so that we can, right now the material is, I think, cement. And these are charge one particles, but they can be, you know, it's a parameter, we can change that. So what you're seeing is things propagating through the charge one particle propagating through the the concrete there, and then secondaries hitting the scintillator array. The scintillator array, the green is scintillator light. Each of the sections are wrapped in aluminized mylar, and so they're getting a total internal reflection through that volume, and then there's a PMT on the face, and so we can get the efficiency by, you know, counting that. Of course, right now the reflection coefficient is such that it's 100%, and we have to measure that, and so we'll degrade this simulation and make it more realistic over time. But this is the sort of first pass we have at a simulation. It's really just the first pass. This is one array. In reality, of course, we're going to have three, but just to show you, since I'm here, what the state of that is. We need to find people and money. The plan, I was telling some of you, is that hopefully we propose this to the LACC by the end of the year. There's an LACC meeting in December, so either that one or the first one next year. And then we go out for funding once LACC approves the experiment. In this picture, it's very thin. In reality, it's probably between 2 and 3 meters. I'm not sure what it is, but yeah, it's probably a muon. It's probably a muon that came originally from CMES. I don't know. Okay, so in this going back to this track paper, there was a list in there of other sort of tracks, which if you misreconstruct them, they could be new physics hiding as misreconstructed tracks. And there was a whole list. One of them on this list was disappearing tracks. This it had been in the back of my mind for a long time to do a search like this. But now at this point, I thought, well, you know, this one is not too hard. I don't have to redo the tracking, and it's very distinctive experimental signature. CMS hadn't done anything like it yet. So I thought it was the right balance of reasonable risk versus reward. And then, of course, I said it has to be practical, but it also has to be, you know, there has to be some motivation. And one of the motivations was, it was a plot like this, of which there are many now, but I thought this is already several years ago. We hadn't found new physics, and where could we missed it? We're going through all of these possibilities, like I mentioned before. But one of them was something with lifetime, and this plot sort of shows that what the range that had been covered at the time within CMS. This is a scan of the one-dimensional projection of the PMSSM scan, where you've made the horizontal axis the lifetime. So these are points in PMSSM space that the LHC in principle has access to. So it's not the full space. The density is sort of arbitrary, so you can't really interpret it as any kind of probability or anything like that. But what it does show you is that down below a millimeter is, you know, sort of easily covered by the old searches, and the old long-lived searches where we look for heavy stable charge particles covering things past a meter. But there is this region of high PMSSM point density, mostly STOW and LSP, I think, but that is not covered at all by the current CMS searches, and so we decided to target it. That plus the fact it was a distinct experimental signature with few standard model backgrounds was enough to get me interested in it. What's so distinctive about this disappearing track signature? Well, you know, you have hits on every layer. When a charged particle goes through silicon, the efficiency is very high to record a hit. So you have hit, stops. What happened? That shouldn't happen too much. This is nothing yet. We haven't talked about what it is, but this is a charged particle that is making tracks a track. Well, we'll talk about it, but you know, that's sort of secondary. At this point, I just want to convince you why this is, you know, doesn't normally happen. Normally, charged particles, you know, the silicon detectors are very efficient. And so this is automatically an interesting thing if you find this in your detector. Something with a lot of layers like CMS's tracker, this should not happen. Of course, there's always reasons that it can happen, and the rest of this talk will be about, just about those. But naively, at the first order, this is a smoking gun kind of thing, just like the fractional charge would have been. And nice because if there was some BSM, you know, charge is conserved, so something came off here. So after you find it, you basically guaranteed if you look at it, you'll find more information. This is what I like about the stop particle search that I do, for those of you who know that one, which I'm not going to talk about. But that's different than the heavy stable charge particle that goes through and out the other end, because you never can find out what kind of particle that was. If you have such a particle, it's going to end up in the Jura when it decays. So it's better in my mind, or at least significantly complementary, to look for the ones that stop, because then you can study them. So this is I like too, because it's similar. This thing will decay, and you could measure its lifetime, its mass, with a dedicated post-analysis after you find a handful of disappearing tracks. And that you can do independent of what model you have in mind when you set up the search. But of course, you do pick a benchmark, and the usual one is the AMSB here, where there's some high energy boundary conditions which tie together the gauge enos so that the masses are, when you evolve them down, are close, and you get something with a small mass splitting, which gives you some lifetime.
Okay.
Yeah. So no, I'm no. So now, so I guess I was just it's just a pedagogical thing. In the previous slide, this is what it will look like normally in CMS. The track goes away. This is now what we think is actually happening. You still won't see this pi plus because if the mass splitting is on the size of the AMSB predicts, it's too soft, and you just have no chance of finding that. Because just think about this. If we have time, let's think about how tracking works. In CMS, you have to do you really have to do a projective thing. But even if you didn't, you would just be assuming that the particle goes straight. You would never assume that it curves over like here. So you have thousands and millions of hits that you have to try to sort out with some pattern. How do you do that? You make some assumptions. So if you don't have Bremsstrahlung, like we did in the old experiments, it's a circle. Okay, so you're just throwing circles on there and seeing what fits on which circles can fit. You don't know the momentum until you start to get the track, so you don't know the size of the circle, the curvature, but at least you know it's a circle. So that's a handle. We don't even have that handle at CMS because there's a significant Bremsstrahlung from charged particles. So the radius is consistently changing. So we have to do a Kalman filter type fit where we make a guesstimate about what's the range of curvature variation you could get from one layer to the next. And this is just too far out of the bounds of possibility when you're trying to cover everything. But when you have a handful of tracks that are disappearing that look like this, and you say, wait, something is weird, then you can make the hypothesis that maybe there's missing energy over here, and maybe you have something curling off, and then you look for some hits over here, and you fit a different type of hypothesis. Yeah.
How far away are the first two layers?
So the first layer is about at 2.5 centimeters, we're moving it in. Maybe 2.5 is the new radius. Yeah, I think it's 3. About a centimeter further, 3. So if it's 3, it's about 4.
I just want to comment a bit. It's not just anomaly mediation, because what's causing the splitting is standard model loop. So really, any new electrically stable thing is that.
Okay, fine. Yeah. And so that's my other comment. There is that there are lots of other ways that you can do that. And so the real thing from an experimentalist point of view is that you have something interesting when you see this. So if this isn't too hard to do, in my book, it's worth doing because you got something. Okay. I said that there are. This should never happen. It's very distinctive. But of course, there always are cases where it does happen, and you have to consider all of them. In the standard model, the type of thing that you have to worry about is charge hadron interactions with a nuclei where you have a charge pion that turns to a neutral pion. That can happen because you have neutrons and protons in the material, and so it has to go through the material, so this can always happen, and then that could be a background. Of course, and in fact, this is a picture of one such type event. Of course, you know, you can, that's pretty distinctive in that the transition happens exactly at a material layer, and so this is not that pernicious of a background, but it's something you have to worry about. Right.
So are those actually not?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but 95% surely is not.
Okay.
So those are lost. So that's actually one of the categories that I'm going to go through, and so I'll show you some. It may well, it's not, I guess we could look, maybe we should wait and see what the numbers are. It's not that, doesn't happen that often, but when it does, you know, that thing is not called an electron. If the question is, well, what does that affect things? Because we have analyses where we think we have electrons and we don't. At some level it must, because that this happens, and those things are not in CMS by default reconstructed as an electron. I can't think of any analyses offhand that have been, you know.
Right. This must have been a direction.
Yeah. Right, but the 95% case, it's just too far away. I'll show you a picture of an event, we do have our electron reconstruction looks for, you know, a significant. It's not a Gaussian cluster in A to phi space. It's a highly non-Gaussian swipe in phi to recover the in A to space. It's more or less Gaussian, but you've got this tail in phi. And those are these things we call superclusters, where we try to recover the phi road. There are limits to how far that can go. And if it's continuous, if it's a bunch of photons, you're better off than if it's one hard brem that carried 95%. That one, I'm virtually certain CMS screws up. Because how do I know that? Because that was an important background for this cert. Okay, and that's, I guess, the next phase of this this talk, which I'm hopefully I have plenty of time because I have been going slowly. There's two ways when you do such a search. You know, you're going to have things like this in the standard model, but the real ones you're going to have to work out, which are going to take your time, are these instrumental ones. Like that's not a physics thing. That's because CMS decided to stop recovery at certain distance, and so you just have to find that out. And that's particular to your experiment. Now you have two approaches at this point, and you can either say find some variable that's, you know, generally distinguishes between anything in the standard model and the BSM, and use that inclusively. And that you might think that's a great idea, and it probably is a good idea to do. And most searches are of that kind. A lot of them are anyway. Or you could do what I'm calling exclusive, where you really try to identify each one, and then when you identify it, you understand it, you mitigate it. And estimate it. So these are two different approaches. The ATLAS analysis, which is a very nice one done by Andy, he chose this inclusive approach, and he uses a track PT to distinguish the standard model effects from the standard model sources of disappearing tracks, including instrumental ones from BSM. Okay, because the BSM should be up here at high PT. It's these phase things. Whereas the standard model and instrumental stuff is back down there. So he does a fit to the data and comes up, concludes that given his knowledge of the shapes of those things in their PT, that they didn't see a signal. This approach is certainly quicker because you don't have to dive into the details. And they certainly beat us by about a year. But my question is, you know, if you had an excess here, would you really be able to claim a discovery? And the answer to that, you know, no offense to Andy, is I don't think so. I know not. Okay, because we have excesses at LHC, and what happens is your analysis gets stuck in a review committee where all the tracker experts come in and find out what happened to these disappearing tracks, and they basically they have to answer these questions. Why you have this excess in this relatively large population? You know, there's not just a few events there, so you have an excess. Maybe let's say this. That's already a large number of tracks. Now everybody is going to be looking at them, and you know, and they'll be studying them, finding out what's gone wrong. With the assumption, with the hope that they can't find anything wrong, and you can have a discovery. But it's very hard when you're under that situation, under that pressure, to do things. You know, first of all, you have to do it quickly, and you don't want to be wrong. So in my experience, it's better to do it the other way around, where you try to figure these things out all ahead of time. And then once you know what they are, you can get rid of them. So instead of having a large background, you have a small background. And then, like in the fractional charge case, where it's kind of an extreme example, you're sure that if you see anything, it's a discovery. That's really what you want to do, in my opinion. Also, if you know about it ahead of time, you can take the time to estimate the systematic uncertainty associated with your estimate. Trust me, when these things take a long time to do, so when you're doing it after the fact under a lot of pressure, you don't necessarily have time to really quantify that. And that leads to things like OPERA and whatnot. Okay, so I'll go quickly over some of the details because I this kind of stuff because I want to get to the rest of the talk. Here is just the selection. The first thing you really try to do is get high PT isolated tracks. The only thing that's worth pointing out on this slide is that the trigger was an issue for run one. We didn't have a good trigger at CMS. We had to because it's an invisible final state. You were basically relying on ISR trigger and the thresholds are too high. We didn't know this ahead of time, so we just had to live with it. Once you've triggered it, you basically make the isolation and you reject any events that you by default reconstruct as emu or tau. So, if it doesn't brem too much, then it's an electron and that doesn't make it into the sample. Then of those that pass that, you just say, well, which of them disappear? And in our definition of disappearing is it comes along and then it has three or more missing outer missing hits that should have been there for some reason. So if this is the plot of this missing outer hits distribution, and you can see the signal is in black here, that populates the large number of missing outer hits, whereas the standard model is piling up down. And here the biggest thing is W to L nu in that bin, but this is sort of trivially eliminated by the disappearing track criteria. That's the reason this is a powerful discriminant. The next thing we add to get rid of what's left is we require that in the region of the track, there's no energy associated with that in the calorimeter. This gets rid of two types of backgrounds. One is the one we were talking about before, where if electrons brem a significant amount of energy such that the track pattern recognition fails, for the reasons that we talked about before, then that would look like a disappearing track. And it wouldn't be classified as an electron. This is an example of this type of event. This is an electron with a very large bremsstrahlung. I think something like 90% of the energy is in this deposit over here. So this is very much definitely an electron, because this happens to be a Z to EE event with something totally consistent to the Z mass if you add that back in. But in the default, this is one we miss. Okay. I don't know what it's called, and I guess it's just a track, normally. So we make a cut here. The signal is down here at the zero bin in what we call e-calo, the energy in the calorimeter, and everything else is piled up on the other side. Where did I say that? The minimum PT on this track is just whatever the minimum PT is for the normal tracking, which I think, somewhere it's in there. So it's That's not the default, but that's to reduce background. So we yeah.
Sorry, can you go back to the slide you were just on?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just lost, like, embarrassing a yellow line.
Yeah.
Seeing yellow lines on there.
Okay.
So can you guide me through this? So the electron, is there a track that's peeking around somewhere in the tracker?
So this is the so you can't see it on this scale. Somewhere along, this is not a track that's been measured in each layer. This is the track that has out missing outer hits. So I don't know. It's the drawing is fooling you because it looks like it's. So this is the track which should be an electron, but isn't. It leaves energy in a calorimeter, but it spun off a photon somewhere around here that ended up over here, and so there probably are a bunch of missing outer hits. Yeah. You would see them missing at some point. Yeah, I think I might have a picture like that later. Okay, and then there are algorithmic sources of missing hits. So you know we explained how this can happen for charged hadrons, how it can happen for electrons, but for muons it really should just never happen, right? But we found a pretty reasonably high. I'm not going to tell you the number because it's actually too high. Number of muons that had missing outer hits. And then you have to just say, why? Then the reason is because, okay, somebody wrote some code at CMS a long time ago that reconstructs tracks and from picks from, if there's more than one trajectory, picks amongst them according to some score. The score calculated by this formula here. 5 times the number of found hits minus 20 times the number of lost hits minus the chi-square of the track. Where did these coefficients 5 and 20 come from? Who knows? It must have worked good on Monte Carlo in 1994 or something like that. But sometimes the wrong, in this case, sometimes the wrong trajectory is chosen because we found cases where, you know, this is what happened. You have a trajectory. This is really what the trajectory was. But this one is chosen. And why is that? Because of this formula. In this case, you have a score of 30.5, and this one gets 39.7 because this has 0 lost measurement. This one has 1 lost measurement, and that's given this harsh penalty factor. So just by somebody's choice of a formula, you're picking the wrong one, and that gives you a source of apparent disappearing tracks. Yeah. So something where you think there should be a hit, but there isn't. So that's lost. But this is not. You don't get so penalized for this. This only comes in as a lesser number of found hits, which has a different coefficient. So this is purely algorithmic. And then, of course, we found out why this blue lost hit is there. That's because, again, the structure of these devices. There's a glue joint in the middle of it, and these blue dots happen to happen when trajectories go through the glue joint. So really, you have no business not picking this trajectory, of course. So muons do leave hits all over. They occasionally miss one when you go through a glue joint, but you really shouldn't count that against the guy. Okay, so we fixed that. We fixed that, and this is not, you know. Right, yeah, right.
There are some that you don't pick up in the muon system.
Yeah, there's some, you know, it becomes harder to do that. When you have the more you miss, the less you know the curvature, and the greater the extrapolation to the muon chamber. So the more likely that will miss as well. Okay, so this is just as an example of the type of thing that you have to do. You can also have unreconstructed muons because they go into holes, bona fide holes that you know about. Okay, as you just said, the track has to be a track plus muon chamber hits. Well, muon chambers are big things, and there are going to be gaps in it. In fact, we have 2 very big gaps right here. That's what you see at 2 positions in eta. And so that's definitely a source of missing outer hits. We have to throw out muons that we don't want to claim a discovery of disappearing tracks and then find out but they only populate 2 bins in eta. But you know, that would be pretty pretty embarrassing. So we exclude these. But then there's also more subtle things. The muons can decay in flight. And that would cause this. Muons can brem too. that can cause it, like we saw with electrons, and they can also create an EM a shower in the EM calorimeter. So all some these things are pretty rare, but this is a rare search for rare phenomena, so you have to take these things into account. Fortunately, you can find out all the answers to this if you look, because you have things like Z's in plenty of, with plenty of statistics. So you have... Yeah, you can. Again, I think maybe I have a picture. Actually, is that it there? Maybe that's it. I didn't label it. But that's, I think that's what I put. You can't see anything. But if you come up here later, that is a muon decay in flight. And this is the calorimeter deposit from the electron. A similar story happens with electrons, where you don't reconstruct them because they've hit either a bad crystal or a gap. We have here, the gap is between the barrel and the end cap. We have a gap that you can't do anything about. And then probably more common is we have crystals that are not so great anymore. And so we have to find them, and we have to exclude them. We start out with the map that CMS uses for all its analyses. And then we add a heck of a lot more, because we're the only people at this point that actually care about this to this level of detail. And so you'd be surprised at how many, I won't go into the detail of this plot, but this is the A to Fly map, which we did with Z to EE events instead of Z to Mu Mu events. And here we found unreconstructed electrons. The difference between the different colors and things are what was there before and what we've had to add. That just tells you the level of this kind of things, like, it just doesn't matter for other people's analyses. So you need to find out how often this happens, right? You can't use the Monte Carlo because it's only as good as what you put in, and this whole point is you have to figure out what's wrong with the Monte Carlo, so you take events that have two things that look like electrons, but one of them you make sure is a bona fide electron, well measured. Then the other one you look for has to be kind of like an electron, but you don't make the calorimeter, a crystal association. You just base it on the track momentum, say. And then you add the mass of those two things, make it consistent with the Z. And so the tag is the well-identified electron. The probe is the one where you relax the conditions so that you can probe this particular quantity. Okay. And we do that for the Zs. We use the Zs to do that for muons and electrons in both the same way. Taus, this is a, I start to make CMS sound bad. And these are very rare things. This is another really horrible example that happens very, very rarely. So unreconstructed taus make it into our sample, because you can have a charged hadron track where you significantly mismeasure the momentum. Why does that happen? Because it's a disappearing track. So you have a shorter lever arm. The momentum measurement relates to how long your lever arm is, how many measurements you have, and how far they are separated in R. So you get cases like this where you have just a W to tau nu, but it should be only a 15 GeV track. But we were measuring it at 75 GeV. So it passes our 50 GeV cut. And then because it doesn't deposit a whole lot of energy in the calorimeter either, because it's a tau, it makes it into our sample. So just another example of things. If you're going to start doing things that people don't expect, like using tracks which don't have all their measurements, you get backgrounds that other people don't think about, because the normal momentum resolution is much, much better than that. It's fraction of a percent. Then, of course, you can have fake tracks. On time, can I go over the two, So I have 5 minutes left. I can try to finish, but if people are happy, I'll just keep going. Okay, so we have backgrounds from fake tracks, which are spurious trajectories that the pattern recognition falsely identifies, right? So it should be just a random set of hits. And this is basically what track isolation and track quality criteria, like chi-squared, tries to get at. But we have to be really careful about this, because those that slip through look exactly like the signal. They tend to have, these are fake tracks. These tend to have no calorimeter energy. And they tend to have a large number of missing hits, outer hits. So this is just like the signal. Okay, so that's the list. That took us a long time to go through to find out all the sources of missing outer hits in the CMS detector and disappearing tracks in the CMS detector. And then now we have to go through and estimate them. I won't take you through the details of this as much, but just to point out that for the lepton backgrounds, you can't just use the Monte Carlo because you don't have enough Monte Carlo. So you have to use a factorized data Monte Carlo hybrid, and that's what we do. We basically measure, we factorize the number in our sample as the number in some data control sample times some probability for the lepton to be misreconstructed or unreconstructed. And then we measure that N control in a control sample. We measure the probability in Monte Carlo. These probabilities can be trusted because most of those things that I showed you were physics processes. They just were rare. For the tracks, you really can't use the Monte Carlo at all because it'll just get it completely wrong. It's a function of, at the micro level, which pixels inside of the pixel detector are not working, much less, you know, the whole module or the, so you try to put this information as much as you can into the simulation, but there's no way. It's you know, maybe just that run something didn't work. So you have to measure this from the data, and we do that with Z's. So you take a Z, you exclude the Z to K product, so it's Z to mu mu or Z to E, where you know you have a Z, and then there should be really no other tracks in that event except maybe the recoil jet or something like that. So you just look in the area which should be quiet, and you look for an isolated track by itself, which if it's there is definitely a fake. And so that's how we measure that. Okay. Yeah, you want to use that, do that in a low pileup sample if you can. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that may be more of a problem in this run. They may have to make sure you're not looking at pileup. It wasn't as much of a problem in that one. So then once you have these estimates, you have to validate them. So we had, in this case, we had two control samples. One was where we relaxed. So the control samples, you invert some cut so that you you're orthogonal to your signal region, but you enrich the background. So here we invert the outer missing outer cut, and here we invert the calorimeter cut. And these are the two distributions that you see, mostly at this stage of the analysis, mostly taus, I guess. And the data that we see in these control regions is very well matched with the predictions from our estimates. So we conclude that they're valid, and then we look at our results. So we had about 10 million triggered events in the sample, and we found two disappearing track candidates. The background, if we add up all those estimates, which I went over a little bit quickly, is 1.4 plus or minus 1.2 events. They're actually, for statistical reasons, a little bit more complicated than that, one-sided intervals and whatnot. But really, it's about 1.2 events. And that's consistent with the data that we see of two. If you look at the properties of the events, remember I said that's one of the advantages of this kind of approach. You can study the events. We know that these events, unfortunately, didn't have anything particularly interesting in them, non-standard model-like. If you look at their track PT, they're at the low PT. If you look at the number of hits, there's one here, probably a fake, because it's got the minimum amount of hits. This is a reasonable, but you know, you made a cut here, so what else could it be? The calorimeter entry, it's a little bit further on this side than you might expect for a signal. If you look in more detail. Yeah, so why did that we change the way we classified that? I think that's in there as taus, because the taus come in as it's taus decays to single prong charged pions. So that's the source of the taus. That's the source of the pions that undergo the charging chain. So this was a sort of editorial decision. So it's W to tau nu. tau. Yeah, because they're in jets. So it's really from W to tau nu, tau to hadronic single prong hadronic tau decay. And so somebody decided we would relabel that as taus. But okay, so we have these two events, and as I said, you can study them. When you have two events, you can study them individually. And I wish you could see these colors better. So for those of you who are interested, you can look at all of the event displays don't come out very well when they project, I guess. We have a black version. I guess that's probably what the black ones are for. Here's our candidate track. That's the thing in red. And those are the disappearing tracks that were found. In this case, if you ask what the PT of that track, it's 70 GeV. It has 7 valid hits. It has this much energy in the calorimeter associated with it. So not a lot, and it has 6 missing outer hits. The DEDX is 3.4 MeV per centimeter, which is on a little bit higher than you expect from Cinnamon, but not because it's a Landau distribution. That's not unusual. The thing that really identifies this is if we reconstruct the mass of this thing with this electron over here, that's basically a Z. So this is a Z to E event where the electron was not reconstructed for one of the reasons that we talked about before. And the other event is here. The PT here is 130. It's got 12 valid hits. It's got 4 outer missing hits. It's got a DDX of 2.9 MeV per centimeter. It's even more consistent with the standard model. There's no reconstructed high PT leptons in the event. This is probably a W to L nu where the L has not been reconstructed. Okay, so then that was what I wanted to tell you about, was all these details. Of course, most of the time, all you look at, I guess, is this part where we had set some limits. To me, that's the least interesting part of it often. So what we did is we set these limits in sort of generic plane of mass of the Chargino versus the lifetime, and then we did a more specific model specific plot where we turned it into a delta M in AMSB, so we can compare it to this prediction from AMSB. Depending on which plot you want to look at, I think this was probably more interesting. We have a maximum sensitivity for lifetimes of about 7 nanoseconds here, and we exclude Chargino's mass less than 505 GeV with that interpretation. If you can go back and compare with ATLAS, we basically have the same limits. If you go in very close, CMS has a slightly better sensitivity because you should always compare the expected limits, not the observed limits. ATLAS got this nice fluctuation, which give them better observed limits, but their sensitivity is really given by this dashed line. And if you compare our dashed line to their dashed line, we're slightly better, but you got to give them credit. They did it a year ahead of us. On the other hand, my point is that next time, I really don't want to make the limit plot. I'd rather be making a discovery plot. And for that, I think we have the advantage. I guess I should show you what happened to this plot that I used as a motivation in the beginning, this PMSSM projection. We wanted to fill in this peak here. And so you can ask how we do. That's before. This is after. The gray is how much this filled in. The editorial police change the binning, and it makes it a little harder to see what's going on because this red is populating a bin which it really doesn't have any sensitivity to because they've taken a large bin. But I guess if you look at it this way and you don't worry about the structure, you could see that there's still a significant amount of space over here at the prompt stuff, but the long-lived stuff is mostly excluded for the very long-lived particles, and there's still some open territory in this disappearing track kind of region. This. Where is what? So over here, did you understand this one before? The black is not excluded. So So, and so we were trying to fill this peak in. This is really supposed to be the same plot. The colors are the same, except for somebody changed the binning. So this is the same peak here as that one. And the gray is the contribution to this analysis to filling in that peak. But whomever changed the binning did a nice job of obscuring that a little bit. Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know. So, you know, my feeling is that this was always nice to try to fill in this gap. It's nice that there's still some left. But even if there wasn't, we'd still do it again. The real thing we gained was the knowledge so that if such a thing pops up in the next run, I think we're ready to make a discovery. what is... Yeah.
But the models are basically pretty similar otherwise from the models.
Yeah.
From the models of prompt decay.
Yeah.
But the same kind of, you know, strong production search or higher electronic search, whatever it is, that found the prompt models.
Yeah.
Would also cover the disappearing track models, wouldn't it? Or
For some reason, I'm not sure what the reason is, but for some reason, they don't provide enough coverage because there is this gap.
But it's like shown as essentially zero, which seems really weird to me.
Yeah.
It
can't be exactly
I'm not
zero.
To say
yeah. Yeah.
About, like,
yeah.
I obviously think the searches are very worth doing, nonetheless.
No, right. No, I think you're right. I think you're right that this may be an artifact of how they did that. Yeah, they must have some sensitivity. It's probably not zero.
But if you have your hard high pKa charged particles coming from a displaced vertex,
yeah,
happening a couple of centimeters in the detector, I can see that just getting thrown out by the second surface.
Mm.
But if it's a disappearing track that you're not really keeping anyway, I don't see why those surfaces would be affected.
But why would the let's talk about it later. But yeah, you may be right that may be some artificial.
Also something I don't know about the quality tests that are usually imposed.
It shouldn't have anything to do. So, it shouldn't have anything to do with it. They shouldn't. They should neither know or not know whether it was a disappearing track. So there certainly would be some quality cuts that would be, you know, if depends how far down into the disappearing track part you go, because all analyses that assume that it's a well-measured track will have some number of hits that they require.
Right, but
so,
I guess what I'm saying is that they would assume largely, unless you're focusing on like reproduction processes, which they don't seem to be, you'd be largely looking at strong production where you're just basically assuming that stuff's going into missing energy, which is a decent approximation of what the missing track's going to look like if you're not looking for the missing track.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So for the next run, this search we're just going to repeat it. The main thing we've fixed about it is the trigger. The problem was we were limited by the MET trigger that we had before, which had its necessarily high threshold. Now we have a new trigger which has a lower MET threshold, and we can do this because we've got the ability to add an isolated require an isolated track. In conjunction with the missing energy. So then, you know, since you have that extra handle, you can lower the MET threshold significantly. So that will improve a lot, about 45%. What's that? It hasn't been set yet. We probably won't know until we start to see the rates in the data. But the turn on is now down. It's this curve, which you really can't see. I'm sorry. It used to be here, and now it's down there. So. Probably can get down to 50 GeV or something, hopefully. If you stay tuned, I'll tell you the exact number in a few months. Okay. I'll go quickly over some of this other stuff. So if you're, I wanted to briefly mention this other thing that I worked on, which was, you know, I never called it this before, but since I'm giving a disappearing track talk, why not call it these appearing tracks? This is a search we did, tried to be very much model independent as we could. Just say you have two displaced leptons where they have large impact parameter. They don't necessarily have to have form a vertex, although they could. There could be jets in the vent, although there doesn't have to be. There could be missing energy, but there doesn't have to be. We just wanted to say if there's anything that's giving these things lifetime, that what the handle we wanted to have. Okay. Then in the practical, that was the theoretical motivation. The practical motivation, the practical realities, in the end, we ended up requiring those things to be isolated to make it a little bit easier. So we sacrificed a little generality on that. And we'd like to remove that in the run and that requirement in the run too. But this one, you know, the particular model that we're showing here is that the RPV stop decay that we were sensitive to. This was a paper that we published where we set limits on a scenario like this, which was called displaced supersymmetry by, you know, Prashant and those guys.
So there's a impact parameter cut, or is it
part of the cut? No, there's an impact parameter cut, and that's basically... That's it. These aren't. This is in a cut flow table. So it was done in different signal regions, which is also not listed. But we had we go down to millimeter. So it's a millimeter to. There's three regions covering a millimeter to. 10 centimeters. Okay. So that's meant to, and the focus of it is on that lower range. Our efficiency is decreasing because it's pretty hard. You don't really reconstruct tracks very well when their impact parameter gets out into many centimeters. So, but I didn't really care about that too much because I think we have plenty of things that are looking already for these sort of really displaced things. My focus here was on things that are really kind of close in that maybe you just either think are prompt or you think they're known standard model kind of. That was my focus. And in the non isolated case, I'm thinking of like you know a Gluino that lives a little bit. We punted on that for practical reasons, so this search wasn't actually sensitive to that. But in the next round, we probably hope to be. CMS, of course, as you know, has other searches that cover similar things, so there's a little overlap. But you know, like I guess in terms of the theme, this was something we added because it covers the gaps at even smaller C tau if there is one. And this was really relatively easy compared to the disappearing tracks. On the other hand, it's not as distinctive of a signature. You can get this from bees, for example, and we did. okay. I've been focusing on long-lived searches. So have CMS and Atlas, and particularly Atlas has recently started to do a nice job of summarizing this, synthesizing these results, seeing where the overlaps are, and seeing where the holes are after we've done all this work, and reinterpreting things that had been done before in different ways. So here's three new plots that came out at the Moriand, I think. That's just, you really can't read anything. But suffice it to say that they each have lifetime on the horizontal axis in some way, and that this isn't a new kind of thing that Atlas is putting out, and CMS will do soon too, where instead of just listing things in the Gluino mass plane, we're listing them in the lifetime plane too, and this is a more detailed plot where you have the actual limits on the Gluino mass versus the lifetime from various different searches that are complementary, and I no longer remember what this one is, but it's... Oh, this is Andy's reinterpretation. So he was wondering about the same question. This is about at the same time we were at ICTP last summer. He was wondering how good do the inclusive searches do at covering slightly long-lived Gluinos. So this is his plot that he made from looking back at the JETS plus missing energy kind of searches, inclusive ones, and seeing how well they did, which was a good idea. I unfortunately don't remember too much of the details of how he did that, but. Okay, so that's what we've been doing in the experimental community, trying to synthesize our results. Some theorists are are also helping here. They don't always just come with the dump truck. Sometimes they come with something to pick things up, too. This guy, Brock Tweedy, wrote a nice paper where, at least for the hadronic picture, he really did try to synthesize everything. And you know, you have to make some assumptions. That's good. That's okay. That's your job. And with those assumptions and trying to recast various analyses, he's able to make some nice planes of this kind, of which I showed just one here, which is Galeno versus C tau with four or five different recast analyses. And in this particular case, which is, you know, Galeno hadronic final state, he shows that we basically have zero to infinity lifetime coverage with the current program. That's not so true. He didn't really look at non-hadronic things, and that's not the story is probably not as true there. So I had this previously made bet for where the new physics is going to show up. I put myself in the yes column. This year older, but I just added myself. But now this is already a few years old for me. And my prediction was something with a C tau of 1 centimeter, just based on my experimental knowledge that this was the area that people were most likely to overlook or find difficult. I don't know if that's still true. It doesn't look so good for hadronic decays based on the Tweedy paper, but maybe it's still alive as a bet for the non-hadronic NLSPs. Okay, sure. Okay, so my bet's not looking so good. Yeah, well, let's look at it afterwards if we can, or today or tomorrow. So if you go back to this list that I start with, are there any other sort of anomalous track signatures that I personally find interesting enough to work on where it might take me a year? And the answer to that, which I didn't know before I started writing this talk, is pretty much no. I think we've got everything that we need, and it's time to just do it. If I go through this list, everything is either covered already, I'm already doing it, somebody else is doing it better. So I didn't find anything tracking-based that I needed to add. And maybe this morning we came up with a few things. I don't know. Nothing really. Somebody was talking about the two leptons. Is that you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So maybe there's something. But so that brings me to my conclusion. You know, we hope we find BSM physics soon. But if we don't, our main goal for the last few years is to try to do it in such a way that if we don't, it's meaningful.
Yeah, the real question is whether this is Sisyphus or is this an Egyptian slave? Because if it's Sisyphus, you're clearly wasting your time.
Yeah.
If it's an Egyptian slave, you have people thousands of years ago looking at the pyramids.
Yeah. Right, well, you know, at least okay, so hopefully it's not Sisyphus, but at least according to Google, it's Sisyphus. So, but. Yeah, yeah, no, it could. You're right. Could be. I didn't want it to be a negative conclusion, but I know you guys are very good at coming up with things that we haven't covered, and the idea that we can cover all of them, that's not. We better not think about that too much and miss executing the plan.
I think we are running out of steam. I think you guys are doing a pretty good job.
Okay, well then we both reached the same conclusion. This is a conclusion, like I said, this is the first time I've given this version of this talk, actually, from scratch.
The thing is, I think, you know, in 2002 or so,
yeah.
When some of us started grad school and
yeah.
Thinking about it, I think there were many things that people were missing.
Yeah.
There were many things that people were really, like, in the Susie box. You
know, right.
They were bombed and
yeah, I think a lot of things have gotten done, and there's sort of a diminishing return on the the most important thing is that we do a good job of doing what we've, the program that we've got. That's my feeling, which is not to say if you don't have any brilliant ideas that, you know, this is a sort of stronger version of the statement that, that I made in ICTP last summer, where you then afterwards had a good idea, which has led to this military experiment, which, you know, wouldn't have happened if we didn't have that conversation. So if you do have good ideas, I'm here for the next day and a half. Please, let's talk about it. But if you don't, then I've got some work to do, and that's it. Right.
Than the standard SUSE searches or
yes.
the standard left of park searches or anything like that. And so my perception is yes, these things are being done.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking longer because they're a lot harder.
Yeah.
And
there's.
We can do about that. And it's taking longer because there's fewer people.
That's right. Yeah. That's
and
right.
If, so I guess even though, you know, there are these, I'm not totally convinced that there's that there aren't scenarios where there could be a displaced vertex. Signature, for example, that has just actually been left out by all the displaced vertex searches so far.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't have my.
Yeah. I don't think that's the case, but.
There may be
some, and we should talk about it. I mean, I didn't mean this to be negative. That I'm here for a day and a half. We should talk about it if there are such things. But my feeling is that, you know, in this metric where you practicality versus motivation, there's not a lot left. So it has to be a very good idea.
Yeah.
No, this isn't like totally great. It's
yeah.
more just sort of proof.
Yeah.
I think you guys are doing a really good job of
yeah.
covering for the broad. Yeah, this is actually the point I was trying to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the case of all of these other
right.
things,
yeah.
there's one person or one
yeah,
person
yeah,
that
yeah.
works really hard for several
right.
years to make a search
yeah.
happen and then repeats that search,
uh-huh.
but without the same level of breadth.
No, that's
yeah.
right. But,
so you're not going to catch the perturbations.
Right.
And it would be nice if there's anything that could
yeah.
be done to get a little bit more effort towards the things that you've highlighted, not new and
yeah.
wackier things.
No, I mean, you know, but this
not
is the
Nazi tracks.
This is a sociological question that there isn't a really. I mean, you know, you might as well say it'd be better for more people to study physics instead of whatever the popular major is at your particular university. You know, they don't want to do it because they're doing what they want to do. And but you know, we have been beating the drum. I mean, I'm wearing the hat as a personal analyst right now. But before, last time I was here, I was wearing a hat of a physics coordinator when I was the deputy physics coordinator of CMS. And there, we were really trying to find ways to motivate people to fill in these gaps. And basically, we did that. I mean, a lot of people got the message. The people we didn't reach, I think, are not, you know, not reachable. They're doing what they want. They're doing what they want to do. They're taking, you know, communications instead of physics or whatever. And and there's just, you know, there's no. Yeah. So, and I don't think there's nothing obviously, and actually, what I think, if somebody's going to spend a few years on a project, at this point, I mean, unless I hear a really good idea, and certainly for me, I mean, I'm not saying that CMS can't invest in, but for me, I'm much more interested in pursuing a new idea like the one we're doing together on this Millichart particle. That seems to be a better avenue for a few years investment than you know trying to do kink tracks or something, which I think is completely derivative of other things. I didn't mention that. I glossed over that in this. But you know, kink tracks is one thing. There's at least.
Can you rebrand it as kink tracks?
Yeah. Well, you know,
no,
that's true. It's not hard to attract people to these things, because but you attract people who don't know how difficult it is to do. And in fact, there is someone working on that, and they probably will always be working on it. And it's not something, in my view, it's not worth the effort. If there is, what's a kink track? It's a track that disappears because the normal reconstruction doesn't see the it loses it after the kink, right? So that's either it's either reconstructable before the kink or after the kink. Most of the time, it would be before the kink, And then you don't, the curvature changes too much, so you can't reconstruct it. So what does that look like? That looks like a disappearing trend. Okay, so it shows up in this search, and then you find the kink later when you're looking for it. Or it's the kink happens early, and the better measured thing is the other half, the second part of the track, the post-kink part. Well, then that's an appearing track. So, I think almost anything that I've thought about, there are other ways to attack it. But I'd be interested to hear what it is. No, whatever it is you've got.
It's more of a threshold. So,
yeah.
I mean, we can maybe talk about it after.
Why don't we end and we talk about it after. Thank you.